the US, Columbia, Yale, and Harvard are all in the crosshairs of this student revolt because of the university's ties with the fabricated child-killing regime of Israel. At Columbia, students are demanding the university end its investments in the tech giants Amazon and Google, which have a $1.2 billion cloud computing contract with the government in Tel Aviv. At Yale, students are demanding the university divest from all weapons manufacturing companies contributing to Israel's assault on Palestine. Yale has exchanged students with 7 Israeli universities. Harvard has programmed with 3 of these universities, while Columbia has relations with 4 of them. As in 1968, many of these protests have been met by force. Columbia President Nemat Minush Shafir ordered the NYPD to disperse the encampment of 50 tents on the South Lawn, which led to the arrest of 100 Columbia and Barnard College students, including the daughter of U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The students were also suspended from school and told they would not be able to finish their academic semester. At Yale, 50 protesters were arrested on charges of aggravated trespassing. At Ohio, demonstrators were beaten and tasered. Nearly 900 protesters have been arrested nationwide since the original confrontation at Columbia on April 18th. And none of this is new. In 1970, the Ohio National Guard opened fire on protesters, killing 4 and wounding 9 students in what became known as the Kent State Massacre. Then, as now, police brutality against students has only caused the protests to spread. Hours after the administration shut down an encampment at Princeton, hundreds of students occupied a central courtyard, bringing books, laptops, and blank canvases to set up a popular university for Gaza. Faculty members joined in, leading teach-ins and discussions. Police have been called into 15 universities across the U.S., and there are protests in a further 22 other universities and colleges. The U.S. protests have spread to British universities, although they have received less media attention. At Trinity College, Cambridge, the portrait of Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary responsible for a statement recognizing the right of Jews to a homeland in Palestine, was defaced and slashed before being removed by the university. London has just seen its 13th national demonstration since the war began. The protests against the war in Gaza, in their persistence and size, are only matched by the million-plus demonstration against Tony Blair's decision to invade Iraq, which in 2003 was the biggest of its kind. The protest movement is having a deep effect on Gaza itself because, for once, the Palestinian people enduring this onslaught do not feel they are on their own. Palestinian journalist and content creator Bisan Auda said, "Keep going because you are our only hope. And we promise we will hold our ground and tell you the truth always. And please don't let their violence scare you. They don't have any other options but to silence and terrify you because you are demolishing decades of brainwashing." Auda is right. If the targets of 1968 protest movement were the Pentagon or the repressive patriotism of a Galilee state, the targets today are Zionism and Israel's armamers in the US, the UK, and Germany. This is the pro-Israel lobby libeling and smearing politicians as anti-Semitic for their support of Palestine. They are the ones causing godless and panicky universities to kick lecturers out of their jobs. they see themselves as the Democrats, but their hands are deep in the toolkit of fascists. They endanger the rule of law, free speech, and the right to protest. Spearheading the revolt against Zionism is a new generation of Jews who are turning up in increasing numbers at these protests. One student at Columbia and two at Barnard explained why. We choose to be arrested in the movement for Palestinian liberation because we are inspired by our Jewish ancestors who fought for freedom 4,000 years ago. When the people entered our encampment, we locked arms and sang civil rights era songs that many of our more recent ancestors recited in 1960s. We belong to the legacy of progressive Jewish activism that has worked across race, class, and religious lines to transform our communities, unquote. The Jewish students said the arrest and brutalization of over 100 pro-Palestinian Columbia students is the worst act of violence on our campus in decades. The moment Columbia asked the NYPD to arrest hundreds of student protesters, our university normalized a culture in which political differences are met with violence and hostility. As we write this, Israeli students passing by call us animals in Hebrew because they think none of us will understand, reminiscent of Israeli war minister Yoav Gallant's remarks that Palestinians in Gaza are human animals. The Gaza war is causing an unprecedented debate among Jewry, with leading intellectuals like the Canadian journalist Naomi Klein arguing that Zionism is a false idol that has taken the idea of the promised land and turned it into a deed of sale for a militaristic ethno-state. Klein wrote, "From the start, it has produced an ugly kind of freedom that saw Palestinian children not as human beings, but as demographic threats, much as the Pharaoh in the book of Exodus feared the growing population of Israelites and thus ordered the death of their sons. Zionism has brought us to our present moment of cataclysm, and it is time that we said clearly it has always been leading us here. It is a false idol that has led far too many of our own people down a deeply immoral path that now has them justifying the shredding of core commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not covet." These events will not be without their consequences. In the immediate future, the anti-Gaza war movement has revived the Palestinian national cause as never before. Fading graffiti commemorating PLO's battles in refugee camps in Lebanon have been replaced by bright new symbols celebrating the attack on October 7th. The inverted triangle depicting Hamas parachuting over the barrier in Gaza is everywhere. Each demonstration around the world is headed by the Palestinian diaspora, which has reacted in the opposite way to what was intended by the Zionist regime and its supporters. The Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu thought that if he killed off the elders, their sons and daughters would forget the struggle. Instead, Netanyahu has recreated and reinforced the bond of Palestinians everywhere to their lost land. Ask Palestinians in the Jordanian refugee camp of Hitin where their home is, and the overwhelming answer is Gaza or the West Bank. This move of support has similarly undone years of planning to disconnect the Palestinian cause from the Arab world. Events helped. The Arab Spring and its suppression and the civil wars that followed supplanted Palestine as the main source of news for at least a decade. The Zionist regime's attempt to bypass the Palestinian national cause by reaching out directly to the richest Persian Gulf states was just about to succeed when Hamas staged its attack. 7 months later, Palestinians everywhere, All polls show it. Instead, the Zionist regime itself is in the dock of international justice under court investigation at both the International Criminal Court, which is about to issue warrants for the arrest of Netanyahu and others, and the International Court of Justice for Genocide.
Covering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? If there is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet, death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death or where did they go. So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, is, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that, be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity, and death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from, and that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet Him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey. And it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is no, and there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, and seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا نزلا من عند الله.
Death is an astonishing pass through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body, and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death, or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ, and they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase. Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls, we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure. But the person, no. The person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is. What is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلِ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that.
And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering, and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body in the once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay? So you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay? It's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, what we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts, and there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into Barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book Masnawi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. and it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
Is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
the limelight.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has reportedly been failing to act on a proposal from a special panel at his department to suspend assistance to the Israeli military over human rights violations and abuses against Palestinians. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website truthout.org has covered this story and tells us more. According to a revealed memo, senior U.S. officials have expressed doubts to Secretary of State Anthony Blinken regarding Israel's claims of adhering to international humanitarian law using U.S.-supplied weapons. According to an internal State Department memo reviewed by Reuters news agency and reported by Reuters on Saturday, 27th of April, a nuanced and divided stance is highlighted within the State Department regarding the credibility and reliability of Israel's assurances. Under a national security memorandum issued by U.S. President Joe Biden in February, the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, is required to submit a report to Congress by 8th of May, evaluating the credibility of Israel's claims, whether they violate U.S. or international laws. By 24th of March, seven State Department bureaus had submitted their inputs for an initial options memo to Antony Blinken. Portions of the memo not previously disclosed were classified. A U.S. official said some components in the department favored accepting Israel's assurances, some favored rejecting them, and some took no position. Four bureaus, including Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Global, Criminal Justice, Population, Refugees and Migration, and International Organization Affairs expressed deep concerns about Israel's non-compliance with international humanitarian laws during the war in Gaza. The joint submission highlighted eight instances of Israeli military actions that officials deemed questionable in terms of international laws. These actions included repeated striking protected sites and civilian infrastructure in Gaza, causing unquestionably high levels of civilian casualties and civilian harm to military advantage, taking little action to investigate violations or to hold to account those responsible for significant civilian harm, and killing humanitarian workers and journalists at an unprecedented rate. Furthermore, the report identified 11 instances where Israeli military actions have arbitrarily restricted humanitarian aid, such as rejecting entire aid trucks due to a single dual-use item. The assessment also highlighted artificial limitations on inspections and repeated attacks on humanitarian sites that should be off-limits. Another submission to the memo, reviewed by Reuters news agency, from the Bureau of Political and Military Affairs, highlighted concerns over the so-called threats to the Israeli regime if U.S. weapons sales were suspended. U.S. aid officials have also contributed to the memo, stating that massacring nearly 35,000 people, with approximately two-thirds being civilians, according to the Israeli regime itself, could potentially be considered a breach of international humanitarian laws. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller confirmed on 25th of March this year that the State Department had received these commitments, but the State Department will not provide a full assessment of their credibility until the report to Congress on 8th of May. The memorandum imposed no new legal requirements but asked the State Department to demand written assurances from countries receiving U.S.-funded weapons that they are not breaching international humanitarian laws or obstructing U.S. aid. President Joe Biden has the authority to halt or impose restrictions on transfer of U.S. weaponry to Israel. Recently, for the first time, he issued a so-called threat to put conditions on the transfer of U.S. weaponry to Israel if it does not take concrete measures to address the critical humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The website ProPublica has also covered the same story and tells us more. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has reportedly been failing to act on a proposal from a special panel at his department to suspend assistance to the Israeli military because of human rights violations and abuses against Palestinians. Citing several current and former American officials, the New York-based news site ProPublica reported recently that a special committee of the State Department known as the Israel Lehi Vetting Forum had recommended in December of last year that Antony Blinken disqualify Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid. However, it added, they've been sitting in Antony Blinken's briefcase ever since then. The panel, made up of West Asia and human rights experts, reviewed incidents including extrajudicial killings of Palestinians by the Israeli police, as well as the gagging and handcuffing of an elderly Palestinian-American man who later was martyred, and the torturing and raping of a teenager. Most of the cases of human rights violations took place in the occupied West Bank before Israel's war on the Gaza Strip started on 7th of October last year, more than 6 months ago. Israel waged a genocidal war on Gaza on 7th of October last year after the Palestinian Hamas movement carried out a historic operation against the usurping Israeli entity in retaliation for the Israeli regime's intensified atrocities against Palestinians, which has been going on for many years. Israel has massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians, many of them women and children. Since the start of the Gaza onslaught, the United States, Israel's most dedicated ally, has fast-tracked weapons shipments to Israel. Washington has also vetoed all United Nations Security Council resolutions that have called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Human rights organizations tracking the aggression against Gaza have collected eyewitness testimony and videos showing Israeli war crimes in Gaza. Josh Paul, a former director of the State Department's Bureau of Political and Military Affairs and a member of the Vetting Forum, said, "If we had been applying Lehi effectively in Israel, maybe you wouldn't have the occupation forces filming their war crimes now, because we have contributed to a culture of impunity." Recently, more than 24 Democratic lawmakers sent a letter to the administration of President Joe Biden calling for a thorough investigation into its claims that Israel was not using American weaponry in violation of international laws. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned Israel's heinous crimes in Gaza, calling for the Israeli prime minister and his terrorist cabinet to be brought to justice. Hamas's political bureau chief, Esmail Haniyeh, was speaking in a recent meeting with Nelson Mandela's grandson, Nkosi Mandela, in the Turkish port city of Istanbul. During the meeting, Esmail Haniyeh strongly condemned the horrendous crimes committed by the Israeli regime in its genocidal war on the besieged Gaza Strip. He highlighted the international community's responsibility with regards to ongoing developments in Gaza, stressing that if justice is to be dispersed, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his terrorist cabinet must be arrested for their criminal acts. Haniyeh also praised South Africa's historic step to file a legal case against the Israeli regime with the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, accusing Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. South Africa's genocide case against Israel was filed at the end of December of last year, after nearly 3 months of Israeli aggression against Gaza. Before filing the lawsuit, the country stated that the occupying Israeli regime had failed to uphold its commitments under the 1948 Genocide Convention.
Paranoia hits major Western news outlets concerning an alleged Israeli strike on Iran as Zionists still struggle to fully comprehend the resonating Iranian True Promise operation that struck them right in the face. Now, the New York Times faces a backlash from its own staff over editorial policies they say have led to a repetition of Israeli entity propaganda and the censoring of Palestinian perspectives in their coverage of the genocidal war on Gaza. Meanwhile, 54% of Zionist illegal colonial settlers have lost all their faith in the invincibility of their occupation army, thinking their entity is now weak in the face of the entire axis of resistance, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. Interesting 2 weeks have passed indeed, ending off with a global mocking campaign against the alleged Israeli occupation's mini quadcopter counterstrikes in response to Tehran's weekend attack on April 14, as Western broadcast media still resonates with the Iranian True Promise operations against the Zionist occupation. Let us hear from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert, about it in Fake News Exposé. Zionist Israel is trapped. Wait a minute, it's not me who's saying it. I know you think that I'm biased towards Palestine, so of course I am, but it's according to all Western media, especially the broadcast one, as per this short clip.
In the Middle East, Israel continues to face threats on several fronts. Today, 18 people, including 14 soldiers, were injured in northern Israel after Hezbollah launched an attack from Lebanon. In Gaza, Israel continues its military operation against Hamas. The IDF says it is also transferring more aid to civilians. And then there is Iran. Israel still weighing how, when, and if it will respond after Iran's attack this weekend. Iran's president said even the tiniest invasion would be met with a, quote, massive and harsh response.
And Zionist Israel is yet to launch its promised attack against Iranian soil, or at least acknowledge that it was them who sent these tiny quadcopters that were downed by Iranian air defense missiles. Now, Fuad, how was your trip throughout this broadcast media since the Iranian attack on the Zionist entity up until today?
Well, Marwa, I'll be very honest. I had to compromise on a lot of gold that I dug up from Western mainstream news concerning this record Iranian attack on Israel, but I eventually had to concede with the best out there. Mm-hmm. First, let's comment for 1 second on the paranoia and hysteria that hit Western news outlets after the Israeli response to Tehran's Operation True Promise on 14 April. Mm-hmm. This was a very weak and a very lame response to the hundreds of drones and missiles that penetrated Israeli air defenses that evening. Mm-hmm. According to Western media, this was Israel's form of limited response, which it reportedly carried out in order to avoid a wide-scale war. But it was so minuscule and so unimpressive that Iran only officially reported the sound of minor explosions and some suspicious drone-like objects that were intercepted by Iranian air defenses. Mm-hmm. Now, despite no official Israeli confirmation or acknowledgement of this attack, this is the frenzy Western media outlets like BBC were in.
There are fears of an escalation in the Middle East conflict after explosions were heard in Iran. Two U.S. officials have confirmed to our broadcast partner CBS News that it was an attack from Israel. State television in Iran has reported big explosions near an army base and airport in the central city of Isfahan, activating local air defense systems. Blasts have also been reported in the country's northwest.
So the attack supposedly took place at 5 a.m., but by 7 a.m., life had returned to normal and all airports were operating normally. So you can imagine how insignificant this attack was.
Definitely.
Let's move on now to MSNBC, which reported right after the Iranian operation against Israel that, contrary to all later reports during the attack, even officials in the U.S. had no idea whether or not the interceptions were even working.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, these interceptions were being aided by three nuclear-powered nations, the U.S., the U.K., and France, plus the Arab protective arm of Israel, the Jordanian government.
So much for the invisibility of Zionist Israel.
All about both the strikes and what the U.S. knows about Israel's plan for a response. What do you know? What did you find out?
Well, let's go through some of this, Alex, and I'm just going through my notes because this call just ended and it was just about, I guess, almost 45 minutes that we were on with these senior officials going through it. First of all, they said it was a very significant attack and that at one point in the Situation Room last night, there were more than 100 ballistic missiles in the air, and the president and his national security team did not know whether they had landed, whether they had been intercepted, because they were only minutes away coming from Iran towards Israel. Separately, I was talking to a senior administration official earlier this afternoon, who told me that all of the missiles and the drones and the UAVs that came from Iran were heading towards a military base, towards one military base in Israel. None went towards any civilian areas. There were other projectiles that did come from other areas, from Hezbollah, for instance, and from other Iranian proxies. But what was so unprecedented about this, of course, was that it was a very large, significant attack, an attack that the officials said intended to create significant damage.
So as you heard, Marwa, the initial MSNBC report just a few hours after the retaliation was according to U.S. officials in the White House and in the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
And they both affirmed that this was a very large, significant, and unprecedented attack, and that they had no viable information on whether or not the interceptive projectiles,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, were worth $1 billion,
yeah.
Had actually worked or not. So MSNBC wanted us to believe that the Israeli narrative that 99% were shot down, which even an Israeli analyst said was false.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to this.
Okay.
When both the Situation Room and the War Cabinet had been through these moments when they did not know if Israel's defenses and the combined Allied defenses were going to work because the ballistic missiles moved so quickly,
mm-hmm.
in contrast to the UAVs and some of the cruises. But those missiles moved so quickly, they didn't know whether they were going to strike. And in fact, what they've now discovered is that 99% were thwarted. They were thwarted, 4 to 6, they said, were thwarted by the Arleigh Burke and the USS Kearney, the two destroyers in the area, the U.S. destroyers. Others were taken down by fighter jet pilots, British and Americans, who were in the air. And then the majority of those ballistic missiles were taken down by the Arrow defenses, the air defenses of Israel.
Where do we start? It's like these people don't have calculators on their smartphones. I mean, 99% means that only 3 missiles landed, whereas Israel said itself that 15 missiles had made it through,
mm-hmm.
at least 15,
mm-hmm.
Which would mean that 5% made it through. And there were only 300 missiles. Let's remember that. Iran fires 120% more than that during regular IRGC military drills.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, even an Israeli military analyst recently told the Hebrew newspaper Ma'ariv that the 99% number is completely wrong, and
mm-hmm.
the real number is more like 84%.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't forget that that's with all the help of U.S. defenses and Patriot missiles and expensive toys, basically, that Israel gets from its friends.
Definitely.
Now, later on during the week, MSNBC kept on emphasizing the Biden administration's demand that Israel not respond to the Iranian operation,
mm-hmm.
and consider the April 14 attack a win for the Zionists.
Top U.S. officials are worried that a potential Israeli response could provoke a wider regional war that the U.S. could be dragged into.
Joining us now is NBC's Richard Engel from Jerusalem, and also with us is retired 4-star General Barry McCaffrey, an NBC News military analyst. Richard, fill us in on the latest from this Israeli war cabinet meeting.
So this is a fast-moving story. As of this morning, it seemed like the U.S. was getting what it wanted, that it had succeeded in convincing Prime Minister Netanyahu, with a call from President Biden directly to Netanyahu, not to respond, to take what happened over the weekend, quote, as a win, the fact that Iran fired hundreds of drones and missiles and that nearly all of them failed or were shot down, caused almost no damage in this country.
But how did Israel respond to these U.S. requests? I think the British outlet Channel 4's reporting about it was quite interesting.
Thanks for the advice and support, but Israel will make its own decisions. That was the message from Benjamin Netanyahu to his British and German visitors who came here to